Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and I just want to thank you for joining the Dr. Drew podcast and supporting the Corolla Pirate Ship here at the Corolla Network. And please, just a reminder, tell a friend about these podcasts. That is how this thing grows organically, and that is how we want this to grow. We want it to be a community of people that connect, and we talk about interesting things. And by the way, feel free to give us feedback and stuff, particularly for my show, that you'd like to hear. We'll be happy to set it up on the program. And again, tell a friend and keep this pirate ship afloat.
This is Corolla Digital.
And welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Reminder to get a taste of those groovy tunes at the Swingin' Sounds through iTunes and the DrDrew.com website. Also, The Boy with the Gun, the incredible tale of Brandon Stocksdale from a criminal to a recovering person to a therapist who helps other troubled youth. And as I've said repeatedly, please don't forget to support the people that support us. I'm very privileged today to welcome to the program Arthur Kaplan. Dr. Kaplan is the founding director of Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Medical Center. I've known Dr. Kaplan since he was days at University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Kaplan, thank you and welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's so good to talk to you again. I always have a million questions for you. Let me just start with something really simple. What is on your radar these days? Where is your focus? What are the things that are most challenging now?
Dead center on my radar, the fight over who ought to get organ transplants. Had a case that's been evolving in Pennsylvania involving a little girl.
Is this the one that's been in the news lately?
It is the one that's been in the news. Mm-hmm. So a little girl named Sarah is at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's dying of a terrible disease, cystic fibrosis, that's ravaging her lungs, and I should add is doing nasty things to other of her organ systems as well. But her lungs are shot. She's clearly failing. They're probably soon to intubate her, and her only hope is a lung transplant. The system that we have for distributing organs has a rule that says kids under 12, and she's 10, go to the back of the line when it comes to getting lungs from adult donors.
Why is that?
And that sounds strange.
Yeah, it does sound strange.
You would think they'd be talking about here.
You think they'd be they'd be a popular source of patients who need with cystic fibrosis who need transplant, and they'd be excellent candidate for transplant.
So a little inside baseball here. You and I both know the surgeons. And even on a bad day, I don't really think they're going to make up rules that say, kick the kids off the lifeboat first. It's not. They may be aggressive, but that's not them. So what's up with this rule? What's up with the rule is this. A kid under 12, it's very, very difficult, nigh on impossible, to fit an adult lung into their chest. We can sometimes squeeze a kidney from an adult into a kid because there's room to kind of joggle it around. You only need one. But with a lung, it's just too big. And lungs are very, very fragile. You know, Drew, if you looked at a kidney or a liver or heart, you can knock them around a little bit. They'll still work.
Mm-hmm.
A lung is like a feather. It's really fragile. It's hard to get out of the body. It's hard to put in. So the surgeons are thinking, the only way we could do this is to take a piece of that lung. That makes them very nervous. The lung is not like the liver. It doesn't grow back. So you're risking damage to something that's pretty frail. I think the reason the kids under 12 are where they are is they're saying, if we have to take a piece, we're really not going to do as well as if we use the whole lung and put it in an adult. So I think it's efficacy that's driving the decision. That said, as listeners will know and you know, the family wasn't going to put up with this back-of-the-line thing. They hired a PR firm. They got a pro bono law firm to help them and went to court. And a federal judge just a few days ago said Sarah's going to go in the pool with the rest of the adults. So they have succeeded in getting the rule, at least temporarily, overridden, which is amazing. I've never heard of a situation where the rules that we have for distributing organs have been, if you will, voided by any third party, judge, congressman, Secretary of Health and Human Services, whoever.
Is there a reason they, I mean, what was the judgment based on?
So that's, this is why ethics is so interesting, because you need good facts to make good ethical decisions. I'm not sure the judge had the facts that I just gave you about the adult size lungs not fitting well into the kids. It also turns out that while you'd think cystic fibrosis would be a disease that's ripe for lung transplant, the outcomes of people with cystic fibrosis as opposed to other lung problems are worse. Remember, I sneakily said when we first introduced this subject that the cystic fibrosis was affecting her other organ systems too.
Right.
And that seems to diminish the chance of success. I was setting you up there for a little.
Yes.
So I don't think the judge heard that. All he heard was, there's a kid, she's under 12, she has to go to the back of the line to get an organ transplant. That seems pretty arbitrary. And
right.
Just like we started out saying at the beginning of this conversation, well, I'm going to put her back on the lifeboat.
Yeah.
Now, compassion is great. The question is, from the point of view of ethics, if she's less likely to be saved, does it make sense to put her on the lifeboat when someone else has to go off? Because this is not a just add her on situation. You put her in, someone's not going to get that lung.
This is sort of the classic pushing the man off the bridge in front of the trolley.
Exactly. Exactly. So, by my lights, I think that the kid rule, you know, it really needs to rest on good facts. We do morally want to put children first. There's no doubt about that. Maybe we want to give them some extra points knowing that they don't quite do as well. But working out which kid is going to do well and which kid isn't is best left for me by the bedside with the transplant guys, maybe with some second-guessing by the bioethicists or some other people. But it's not a good thing to argue out in Congress. It's probably not good to have the rationing done in a judge's chambers. Those aren't the best places to do it because you're kind of losing touch with the biological medical facts that you need to decide who's the best candidate.
Well, let me move off of that particular case into a more global issue. I don't know if we can even distill it down to a specific conversation. But to me, this puts a bright light on the intrusion into the practice of medicine by systems and lawyers. I mean, it's and bureaucracies. All sorts of things have intruded. If attorneys had their relationships adulterated with their clients the way physicians have routinely, they would be screaming from every mountaintop. And yet they continue to erode on into that. You know, they'll say, "Oh, my relationship with my client—that's privilege. That's sacred. My relationship with my client." Yeah, the patient-doctor relationship—they're fine going on in there and meddling around. And every time they do, just—I'm sure you have many thoughts about it. But the one thought I have is that it makes it less efficient rather than more at a time when we need efficiencies in the system.
Well, efficiency is a problem. Let me take one example right out of your area of practice. So New York State and other states, but New York passed one, has a law now that says it is a legal requirement in treating someone with a mental illness to report if you think they are likely to be violent or cause harm to others, and then the police or someone will come in and see if they own a gun.
Right.
So we have this new reporting requirement relative to firearms. At Bellevue Hospital, there are a lot of mentally ill people and a lot of addicted people where I now work. Probably a third of the people that come in every month might qualify as agitated, violent,
right,
upset.
Right.
We're reporting thousands of names all of a sudden to the cops, to the health authorities. They're not going to do anything with those names. They're overwhelmed by them.
Hmm.
So the question is this, not just efficiency, which that is an efficiency problem. Are people going to go to the psychiatrist and think, I'm going to report your name to the cops?
Right. Right.
So that drives me crazy. We have other instances of this. You remember, we have all these states passing laws that say before a woman can have an abortion, you have to read her this thing, and you have to show her this video, and you have to do this, and you have to do that. To me, it's always been up to the doctor and the patient to decide how to exchange information.
Not anymore.
If you don't want to hear it, or you don't want to listen to it.
Not anymore. Are you kidding? It's all intruded all into now.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, if it, you know, if you sit there and I say, Dr. Drew, I really don't want to hear that. I trust you. You make the decision. And you say, well, Art, you really should think about the risk and benefit. I say, really, I want to trust you. You're the expert. You tell me what to do. I have the right to waive my consent. I don't have to listen to some Miranda-like warning on a legal form that lawyers like. Conversely, if you're telling me things that make me upset or make me cry or make me disturbed. I don't think I have to sit through them, and you shouldn't feel obligated to impose them on me at that time. Muddling around in this doctor-patient relationship, it's not just bad for efficiency and cost, it makes for crummy medicine.
Yeah, but this boat is not turning around. It's full speed ahead.
It is, and I think for a lot of people, they're sort of like, well, sure, Congress ought to tell them to do this, and Congress should tell them to say that. Really?
Right.
I mean, think hard, folks. This is the person who, is not going to follow up the consequences of your medical decision-making. This is not a person who knows your situation or circumstances. Having them start to mandate what goes on in your conversation with your doctor, bad idea.
But there's such confusion in the public by what even doctors do. It's so amazing to me that they don't really even understand why they go to a doctor. They think they're going for the same body of information that, say, they could look up on the internet or WebMD or something. When in fact, what I always tell people is, look, what you can look up on the internet is what we know in our second year of medical school. Then we spend another 8 years learning the clinical application and the nuances to develop our judgment to make
call. Say, or learning why some of that could be wrong in your case.
It's right. It's about you come to a doctor to make the right call, for a judgment call. That's all you're there for. Is to figure it out and then make the right call. You could probably figure it out yourself online. That's okay, and you can. And certainly, I have patients bring in stacks of information that literally just say, "The sky is blue. The sky is blue." Yeah. I know the sky is blue. I know that. But for your circumstance and your age, with your family system and your belief system and your concomitant disorders and your wishes and desires of how I manage your case, there's a very specific judgment call that we're going to make together. But it's the judgment that you go for, and if that is interfered with in terms of now here's my judgment, you hit your head, you're a 17-year-old healthy person, you fell off a ladder, hit your head, you kind of saw stars, your mom brought you to the ER, I don't think you need a CAT scan. But the medical legal system may kick in and say, if you didn't get that CAT scan, I don't care about your judgment or your whatever your call was, you're liable. And now here we go.
Absolutely. I just had a radiologist complained bitterly to me. He said, look, when I do a scan, just an x-ray, CAT scan of somebody's chest, I may see some things that they weren't looking for.
Right.
Sometimes I see things that are sort of odd, gross. I'm not worried about them, but lawyers are lurking around there. And if I don't say, I cannot rule out cancer, I cannot rule out this.
That's right.
Well, now the patient is flipping out. What do you mean you can't rule out cancer?
Well, forget, no, forget the patient.
We're going to run off and get 12 more tests.
And forget the patient flipping out. You've just quintupled the cost of medical care for that patient.
Because now you put
the obligation back onto every person who reads that report to follow up, get another scan, do another set of maybe an MRI, maybe get a needle, whatever, maybe subject the patient to something dangerous. But more importantly, we're going to spend a ton of dough and time following
chasing,
this patient now. Yeah,
chasing
nothing. Chasing nothing that in your
vapors.
Judgment, if you could just use your damn judgment, you could tell me, the radiologist could tell me, don't worry about this, let it go. But he can't do that.
And while we're venting on this, which I assure you I'm trying very hard to fix, and I'll tell you how in a minute.
Okay.
If you look at the internet, and I'm not saying people shouldn't look at the internet. The internet's fine. It's a tool. But remember, the internet is about as reliable for information in healthcare as it is for getting a date. That is to say, a lot of people put up descriptions, and you meet them. I mean, I'm not doing this. I'm married, but I hear this. that say, hey, I thought you were 5'5" and 100 pounds, and you turn out to be, 6 foot and 380 pounds. What are you doing here? You can't always trust it just because it appears on the internet. We know that in a simple-minded way, but when it comes to healthcare stuff, it's not vetted. It's not peer-reviewed. You have to sort of look at it, and that's a starting point for a conversation.
But the average person doesn't have the frame of reference to evaluate the information even. So,
and worse, it's average information. That's what you were talking about before about judgment. So here's cystic fibrosis, is a bad disease and a lung transplant might fix it. But for this little girl we were talking about earlier, she's got a very aggressive form of cystic fibrosis. She's dying at 10. Most people are dying at 30. something is really nasty with her version of this disease and it's wrecking the rest of her body systems, that may count her out relative to the transplant. But you're not going to get that on the internet. It just might say cystic fibrosis. One indication is lung transplant.
Right.
All right. So what's the solution that I promised?
Yes,
right,
please.
Now?
I'm all
you know,
ears.
We're all hepped up these days about Obama's health reform.
Yes.
One of the things that is supposed to happen is we're going to collect information on what works. So it's called comparative effectiveness research, sometimes called CER. We're going to study this and that and see, you know, do we need mammograms for women every year from 40 to 50? Data doesn't look like it supports that.
Wait a minute. Don't we already do this kind of work?
We do, but now we're going to do more. They're putting more money in the pot, you know, really try to encourage it. It's the key to cost containment for them, you know, weed out the bad stuff that doesn't work, pay for the stuff that does. Whether that's going to happen, I don't know. But here's the neat trick. If you could get guidelines out of this data that said, if you do X, Y, and Z, you are within the guidelines of what's accepted practice, that would put the lawyers, set them back on their heels. Because right now, all they have to do is drag somebody out of somewhere and say, well, if I had had that patient, I would have done 49 tests and 58,000 diagnostic biopsies, and I would have found that cancer that ultimately killed them. Having guidelines, which may come out of the Obama health care reform, that people could use as a reasonable safe haven or safe harbor to point to and say, I did what the guidelines
but,
say.
But we have clinical pathways. We have standard. We have stuff like that already.
But we write them. Now the government's writing
them. Well, I was going to say, is the federal government going to somehow impose laws that say if you follow these guidelines, you are should be immune from attack?
That's what I want them to do.
Okay. Well, then
That would be a big deal. That's my little plan. I don't know how far we can get with this one, but I really think it's a great idea to link protection for people. And lest listeners think I'm, you know, just trying to defend the docs, it's evidence-based. It's the right course to take. A lot of the stuff you're getting, you don't need. It's over-testing, or you're going to get sicker because we're doing things like giving you too much radiation or causing all kinds of side effects. So this isn't just me being protective of poor old docs getting chased around by lawyers. This is trying to get the best standards of medicine to be what the standard is of care.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about how people don't trust the medical system and don't trust doctors. They don't understand that the wolf has been in charge of the chicken coop, and the only really the farmer who really is tending to the chickens is the physician. That's all we do is we try to put the patient ahead of everything, and nobody else has that priority. Nobody does.
Well, it's certainly the case that your insurance company doesn't.
Your attorneys
sure your
don't.
Lawyer does.
No, he wants to collect money. He wants to get you compensated. Not
right.
Your...
I'm even pretty sure that in some ways, if we looked at the price lists that have been coming out lately in Time Magazine, New York Times, other places that hospitals are charging, you might say, I don't know if they're really looking out as institutions for you. It is the doc. And by the way, we'll add in the nurse.
Yeah,
for
sure.
Frontline
and all the other practitioners. Frankly,
yep.
I mean that's all.
Yep.
Everyone's there for the same reason.
Yeah,
but people understand the buck stops with the physician. That's where everyone goes. Well, I don't know. You ask your doctor, that'll be up to the doctor. It's like when the shit really hits the fan, they all deflect upstream, and so they do, and so you end up being the one making the decisions for the patient.
Exactly. So, again, what we want to start to do is push our legislators and so on to say, hey, let's try and let the doctor act as your advocate. Let's put them in the role where they can make the best judgment. Let's stop having the whole system tipped over, either by people who want to make a lot of money chasing down possible mistakes or middlemen who want to charge a lot for administrative overhead. That's not the way
that's
to go.
Crazy.
And if we don't fix
that's
it,
crazy.
You know, we got an aging population, right?
We got to fix it.
You got to fix it.
But there's going to be – I think there's even going to be confusion about who or what a doctor is in this new system because primary care is going to be delivered by not physicians for the most part, it seems to me.
Well, you're right. You're right because we don't have enough. We have too many specialists and not enough primary care people. I've tried to say to my doctor friends, look, you got to let nurses do a bit more. You got to let the pharmacist give those flu shots. You have to stretch physician assistants more. We just don't have the primary care people. Now, if it were up to me and I were king, I'd say anybody who wants to enter family medicine, general internal medicine, let's knock off three-quarters of their tuition in medical school.
Yeah.
They'll really be useful to us down the road.
Yep.
We got to build them. But even if we started that tomorrow, what would it be, 9 years before we saw them practice?
That's right.
So it's got to be others doing it, and let's try and make them as good at it as we can, but we don't have the troops in primary care.
As it is, well,
side.
part of the way it's going to go is you have the exact opposite situation in effect, which is primary care is so poorly reimbursed that they can't pay for their education.
Yeah.
So they have to go on to something else.
That's why I said let's start taking the scholarship and the subsidy seriously. The people who need it are the primary care.
They're never going to reimburse them more. I've heard that BS for 25 years, and they've never exchanged the reimbursements ever. It's always seemed ridiculous to me that I could spend all night in an ICU keeping somebody alive and get $130 from Medicare, while a plastic surgeon could do a 7-minute procedure and charge $20,000. It's orders of magnitude out of line.
No other country has this.
Yeah.
I mean, we're remarkably unique in our bizarreness about this.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you this. Over the course of your career, has how you have seen the bioethical landscape changed? And do you have a different take or a different – has it just changed where you focus, or you've actually changed your sort of approach and outlook?
Well, it has changed. I'll go that way first. When I first started thinking about these things, and I was wandering around the Columbia Medical School, it was a pretty paternalistic world. So doctors decided what was going to happen. We didn't have a lot of arguments about stopping care. Back in those days, I'm talking late 70s, early 80s, we didn't have as much technology. But shutting it off wasn't a big issue. We didn't have Terry Schiavo fights. The attending came in and said, shut it off. We didn't have a lot of discussion with cancer patients and even in the early days of AIDS about their diagnoses. You tended perhaps not to talk to them about what they wanted and so forth. So the pendulum swung far more toward respecting patients' rights and values and autonomy, and bioethics played a big role in that. And I think that's been good. Today, however, it swung so far over that now if I come into the office, you gave that example earlier about the kid who banged his head. So if I came in as a parent and said, my kid banged his head, I demand that you do a CAT scan, what are you going to do?
Right.
Well, now a lot of people say, I can't refuse that. You're in charge. It's your values. So I think there's been, in my lifetime, a useful attempt to get rid of too much medical paternalism, try and get the patient in there as a partner. But now it's gone the other way.
Let me say, that's what I was talking about, where people don't understand they're coming there for the doctor to make a call. They don't get that.
Exactly.
They don't even understand that's why they're there. They don't even understand.
So let me give you end-of-life care discussion. Here's how it goes now. Mr. Smith, your dad is not doing very well. We need your permission to shut off his dialysis or to stop the medicine that's maintaining his blood pressure, his pressors. Well, I don't want the doctor pushing that way. I want the doctor to come in and say, the time has come to stop your dad's dialysis. We're going to make him comfortable. Do you have questions about that, or do you want to talk about why that's my recommendation? I want to hear doctors still making recommendations, using their expertise, acting as people who have a lot of experience. I don't want them simply coming up like waiters in a restaurant saying, you want some of this,
and that's what's so crazy. I tell my patients all the time, I go, look, here's what I do when I see a doctor. I go, use your best judgment. Just go do it. What's your best judgment? What's your call? That's all I want. I don't want special. I don't want special. Because special is...
You got me choking here a little bit because I'm laughing. I think I wouldn't go quite to where you are, but what I'd say is this. If I came to you and you said, I think you ought to do this, this, and this, I'd say, I don't want to hear that. And let me think about it a little bit. I might want to ask you a question if I got any more options.
Right. I might ask some questions.
But I sure
about
want
it,
to so. Hear what you think.
I go, what's your call? I go, what do you want to do? And I go, oh, do it. And I might sort of push back a little bit. Well, it doesn't fit for me, or maybe my timing or whatever, maybe, or did you consider this or whatever? Now, mind you, I have the frame of reference to do that. I understand the context in which he's making that call. And patients, you need to build that context for a patient. I understand that's my job when I'm the doctor. But once I build the context for them, I want them to go, okay, what do you recommend? What are we going to do here? And I take in, by the way, as part of the context, their point of view and things. And yeah, I always do that. I always go, and I, in fact, I waved. I was part of a research study too, where I said, "Don't even read me all the stuff. I know, I'm fine. Let's just do it. Let's just go." And so that's my thing: is use your judgment. But part of that is don't treat me specially. If you treat me specially, even if it's because you're doing extra special careful care, somehow that translates into mistakes. So just treat me the doctors are trained to give the best care to every standard care to everybody. Don't give me special care because that's not going to be better.
Extreme.
Yeah.
Remember what happened to Michael Jackson? He hired his own personal doctor and then bullied him around.
Perfect example. Perfect example. Nothing's when celebrities always want special care. The best. Well, this guy's so great. No. Don't do that.
I got another story to tell you in this regard. Over the years, I've spent a lot of time working around transplants. And so it's not uncommon for a very rich person or someone to come from some foreign land, the sheikh of somewhere, and say, I demand that the chairman do my surgery.
Right.
And you're thinking, the chairman hasn't been off of a desk in like 20 years.
Right, he hasn't operated in forever.
He's going to kill you dead.
Yeah, right.
I want the senior resident to do this somebody looking over his shoulder. But
that's right.
And so I see it all the time. People do not understand at all that, some of the best care and some of the best judgment is given by those frontline troops who manage the ICU, stay in the ER. It's not the guy who's necessarily pushing papers behind the desk. And it lets me reinforce the other thing you usefully said, which is, I want to hear your expertise and experience and your opinion. Tell me what you think.
Yeah.
I really want to hear that. I don't want you giving choices to me. That's not respecting my autonomy. Put it another way. What I've learned over the years is informed consent is not spoiled by the doctor giving an opinion.
Right.
It's what you expect, but we have gotten too far away from that.
Let's go back to, you mentioned Michael Jackson. Did you have a read on that case?
I did. I thought basically the doctor that he hired was inept.
Well, certainly for mental health. You know what I mean? Forget the cardiology part. He didn't even understand what he was into from a mental health standpoint.
And then just so listeners keep this in mind, he was using drugs powerful enough that they're locked up and only used by experts in the hospital. You'd never see them used in home use
ever.
To put somebody to sleep.
Ever. When I first heard that, you could have also told me that an asteroid landed on my backyard. It would have been just about as equivalent to a shock.
But the worst part is, this guy sort of used this as defense. You know, I did what my client wanted, and I didn't want to get on his wrong side and on his bad side. Look, if we did that, one of the areas that, you know, I don't have to tell you about is addiction. Hey, you could say, I don't want to get on my client's bad side. If you don't push them and prod them and nudge them and hector them and pound them, how are they going to get rid of things that haunt them and that compel their behavior? You can't just say, I'm going to, you know, indulge my patient's phobias, indulge my patient's whims and fantasies. That's not doctoring. That's pandering.
But you would be shocked, though. You would really be shocked. As someone who worked for years in internal medicine and then years in a psychiatric hospital, the lack of understanding on the general medical side about mental health patients and what they need. We really got zero training in it. We do the majority of the prescribing of the psychotropic meds, and we have A, very little diagnostic training, so we're doing unsophisticated diagnosis, but B, more importantly, the overall approach to the patient, they never really learn how to do that. That ability to set limits and to create teams and to know, you know, when you're in trouble, when you need referrals, and when you can go on your own, when you can't, and when you do collaborate with the patient and when you don't. And it's really, you know, we're taught in medicine, in general medicine, you're there, you're at the patient's side, and you meet their needs, and you do it 24/7. That's it. And if you have a borderline patient on your hands, I haven't helped you.
To me, this is all very interesting, too, because the way I would put it is I've learned, you asked what I'd learned or changed my mind about, I've learned something else. Sometimes in a person with a mental illness or an addiction, and I see this a lot, you have to interfere with, take away, or restrict their autonomy to build them back to a self-determining person.
That's right.
It does them no good to simply say, well, let's negotiate your meds when you're, you know, floridly schizophrenic, or I'm kind of interested in your views about whether you want to kill yourself when you're severely depressed. You've got to sometimes override things. And by the way, just to come back to our favorite subject, the law and lawyers, all oriented towards civil liberties, I sometimes call this allowing the person to rot with their rights on. What is the favor done to a mentally ill homeless person in saying, well, he says he doesn't want his meds, therefore that's the end of the treatment?
Yeah, I come involved with this all the time, which I've always said, if they would allow me to restrict civil liberties even more, I could really help some people.
Mm-hmm.
I think about that poor psychiatrist at the University of Colorado who was treating that mm-hmm. kid mm-hmm. who shot up mm-hmm. the theater. From every hint I get about what went down there, she did everything by the book. But she got to the point where she was saying, it is my judgment this person is dangerous, mm-hmm. and people and some less skilled people went, oh, leave the poor kid alone. Who are you to mm-hmm. say? Kind of, you know what I mean? I'm sure that's what happened. That's what happened.
I do. And, you know, a lot of people who are family members of those with mental illness also tell me bitterly they're cut out. They can't get information. It's the patient's rights that come first. So
yes.
They aren't able
to help.
To assist.
Yeah.
That seems all backwards to me. You'll be happy to know that one of my other little causes is to try and bang a little bit into this values area of mental health, because I think, just to give a concise example of what's wrong, if you're a danger to yourself or others, I should ask you this, how long can we keep somebody?
72 hours. If they're saying that the whole time. They have to keep saying, I want to kill myself. I plan to do it. If they plan to do it but say, I'm not going to do it, we have to let them go.
So what are we talking about? 72 hours?
Yeah, yeah.
Are we serious?
Yeah, right.
Come on.
Yeah, and maximum, by the way, 14 days.
So, you know, it seems to me that's a place where we can have some straightforward discussion and say, how about 30 days? I'm not trying to reopen the old mental institutions where people were warehoused and you said goodbye to them for a lifetime and, you know, the conditions are miserable and so on. But 72 hours, it's hard for me to think of anything that ever got fixed.
Here's why
bodily
that,
or mental.
Right. Here's why this will never happen. The insurance companies. The average length of stay in a psychiatric hospital is like 3 days, no matter what. Listen, I had patients that routinely needed 6 months of treatment for addiction, mm-hmm. and I was fighting for each day. Maximum I would get would be 5.
Yeah.
It's crazy, and they'll scream you down every day of every single day.
So the other part of this equation is basically we've transformed mental health into pharmacology.
Yes,
the pharmacology helps. I'm not saying it doesn't help people, but it's not the long term solution to the underlying problems. And I think it's still penny wise and pound foolish.
Of course.
It might sound crazy to hold somebody 3 months, but if they're bouncing it, well, I'm preaching to a choir of one here.
It just won't happen. I know one. I worked too long in those hospitals to know it will not happen.
you know, us Ephesus, we have hard heads.
Oh.
We can go back and bang on that wall some more.
Please go. I just don't see it ever happening. It'd be so great if we could really, because the one sort of ingredient that people don't sort of put any utility in is a structure and time. And then the interpersonal experience, you know, the relationship has been expunged from medical care as a useful therapeutic instrument.
Yeah, yeah, and that shouldn't be. That right. just shouldn't be. That's not good medicine. Hey, I got one other thing that is in my face these days, talking about evidence-based medicine and trying to figure out what works. There was a study that was just under the gun by regulators of preemie babies. What they were trying to figure out was a pretty narrow range of giving the preemie baby oxygen, which they need because their lungs are poorly developed. Is it better to give them, say, 85% oxygen or 92? Nobody really knows.
Okay.
They've narrowed the range down, but they're not quite sure. So they did a study, and they basically randomized which baby went where, and without really knowing whether A was better than B, 85 or 92. The regulators came in and said, that was completely unethical. You can't do that study because you didn't inform the people that their baby could die or go blind or have these other side effects.
Mm.
Well, I think that's craziness.
Right.
Why? Because the people are told this as the reason their kid is in the hospital, that, you know, they're very sick, they could die, they could go blind. We don't know what's the best thing to do. Nobody introduced any extra risk by randomizing the baby. It sounds like a experiment on babies. But if you don't really know if 85 is better than 92, what's the risk of just saying randomly we'll do it?
Right.
There's none.
Right.
I think people don't understand even the basics of human experimentation. It's one thing to test a new drug or device. It's very different thing to say, I don't know what the heck is better or worse. Let's take a look, but it's not putting you at any risk because I don't know whether it's better or worse.
Yeah,
or less.
That's one layer to all this. I'm going to go all the way to the mat and say, you know, not only people don't understand the basics of experimentation and statistical analysis, they don't understand science. We have such poor science training. It's really sad. But let me we got to kind of wrap up in a few minutes. But I want to talk about something, another sort of pet peeve of mine that surgeons do, and I almost referred a case to a bioethics committee, but it troubled me so much. And I sort of didn't want to put the family through it and stuff, but this notion, I have surgeons do this all the damn time. They go in, they have a grade 3 or 4 tumor, you know, we're late in the game getting the diagnosis, and they take out the colon, and they come back in the room where the family's waiting and say, we got it all. And I'm like, yeah, got it all to a family means I cured your loved one. Please don't say that.
Are you
a solid tumor, adenocarcinoma? It's through the wall of the colon, mm-hmm. and you're mm-hmm. telling somebody that is a grotesque ethical violation, in my opinion. And yet they do it all the time.
They do it all the time. I absolutely can resonate to the complaint here. So the reason this is so dishonest is, this thing is through the wall of the intestine. We know that it's going to spread elsewhere. It probably already has. Yanking it out of the intestine is nice, but you're not buying people much time, and you're not preventing a whole lot of suffering as they die anyway. So,
yeah, you got it all. Great. Now, so what? That's why I sent you in there, was to get it all, not to cure the cancer, because you can't.
And then the family's thinking, great.
Yeah, we're done.
So let's use all the technology and, you know, womp on this guy, and this, you know, we have hope, and it'll be tough, but we'll chemo him and radiation.
Dr. Campbell, they're confused about they. Then you have to go through a whole thing about why chemo. Well, they got it all. Why chemo? It's worse than you can imagine, and once somebody says, it's like telling a drug addict they can have medication. Is once they hang on to that, we got it all. They do not want to hear any other point of view.
As long as we're complaining about this, let me add one, and then I'll try to wrench us perhaps a recommendation or a solution out of this. So
okay.
My pet peeve is, when you have cancer, all the oncologists, when your kidneys start to fail, as they do as part of this, they send everybody over to nephrology to get dialyzed.
Right.
It's very hard to die in America without being on kidney dialysis.
Right.
Well, if you're dying, your kidneys are going to fail. Having you lie around in a coma or worse, suffering, because we now have you on a dialysis machine, makes no sense whatsoever, and it's certainly part of the reason we're spending, get this, $8 billion a year on kidney dialysis.
Oh, gosh.
So,
that's crazy.
What's going on? Our doctors, we need to be able to say things like, we can't fix this, but we'll do all we can to make you comfortable and extend quality of life for you. That's
very,
a conversation that
very few can say that. Or how about, by the way, getting people to hospice early?
Yep.
Before they really need it, but you have to have the conversation early. There is one bright spot in the story you're telling, which is palliative care is coming on. There are people, teams who are willing to say this and do
That's
it
where
in
I was
a beautiful
go.
Way.
So we have that specialty, and I think we're doing a little better, at least, in starting to get them there a little earlier. The joke I tell is, by the time we start talking about hospice in England, they've buried the person.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's right.
So we're way late on that. And palliative care, really, think about it, should be part of everybody's care in the hospital. You know what I mean? It doesn't have to just be the terminally ill. But, yeah, that is a bright spot. That is a good thing. Absolutely.
It's just people need to use it more. Hospitals need to mandate. And, again, I'm not saying there should be laws in place, but hospitals should mandate it as part of quality care. So that's all I'm saying. Well, okay. Thank you for this conversation, Dr. Kaplan. I really appreciate it.
And it was a pleasure.
It's always a privilege to speak with you, and I hope you'll come back again as the stories hit the press, because I think this is an important area for people to be aware of, because obviously we're coming into a time when things are going to be changing rapidly, and consumers, patients, and doctors need to kind of keep their eye on how this is going to work.
And we got an aging society with more health consumers coming, so that also is another reason you got to pay close attention.
Any websites or books or publications we should look out for you?
Well, probably the NYU Medical Ethics site is a good one. Just as a resource, it's not just promoting my thing, but it's Pop Health Med NYU EDU Medical Ethics. So you can just Google NYU Medical Ethics, and that'll give you good resources if you're interested in living well or you want to see a little bit more about how to consent to experiments and that sort of thing.
Great. Dr. Arthur Kaplan at NYU Medical Center, founding director of the Division of Medical Ethics. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully I'll see you soon. We're going to take a break and back with your calls after this.
Allison Rosen. Hey, everyone. It's me, Allison Rosen. I wanted to tell you about an exciting format change on Allison Rosen is Your New Best Friend. On Mondays, I sit down with guests like YouTube superstar Shane Dawson or Mad Men's Kevin Rahm or Bob Saget or conservative pundit Mary Catherine Hamm. And then on Thursdays, I sit down with my coworkers Gary, Matt, and Chris, and we answer your questions and get into arguments about important stuff like whether purple Skittles are disgusting, which I think they are. Join in the fun Mondays and Thursdays. Subscribe to Allison Rosen is Your New Best Friend on iTunes or go to AllisonRosen.com. I love you.
Allison's your new best friend.
Welcome back to the Dr. Who Podcast. Thank you again, to Arthur Kaplan, who is check his stuff out. He's really one of the leading ethicists, medical ethicists in the country. We're going to now take your phone calls for a little while. Hey, guys, did I ever have Amy Kramer on the show from National Campaign to End Teen and Unwanted Pregnancy? Okay, that's right. Because they've got a big thing coming up. The numbers keep getting better in Unwanted Pregnancy, and they're having a big thing in the fall. And I was thinking, I'm going to get her back for this. Well, let's go on out to your calls. This is now Josh. Josh is 34. What's up, Josh?
Hey, I've got a situation with my sister and her husband. Mm-hmm. We believe it's an abusive relationship. I don't think there's any physical abuse yet, but there's definitely emotional abuse. He's isolating her from her family, stuff like going through her text messages, emails. He erupts if there's any contact with friends that are male.
What do you mean erupt? What have you seen?
I mean, like... severe yelling, anger, fights.
You've seen this?
Well, I've been told this by her. What I've seen personally is him react angrily in kind of situations that don't require anger. For example, we've been in a restaurant and somebody bumped my sister's chair and he like threw his menu on the ground and went and got up in the guy's face. I mean, it was just a total innocuous situation.
Right.
And I saw that. I mean, that was kind of the first, that was a couple of years ago, it's kind of the first indication of this, something's not right here.
All right, let me get some background information. Is he using substances or has he ever used substances?
Yeah, I know he has smoked pot and alcohol. Those are the only two things I know of. He's also a workout freak kind of guy, does the cage fighting stuff, that kind of stuff.
Okay,
so I don't know if he's on supplements or anything like that.
Forget, so he's probably on steroids, right? Is he all jacked up?
Yes, he's definitely all jacked up.
Okay, so the steroids can make people extremely aggressive, in fact, uncharacteristically aggressive. And, you know, did you ever see, there's a TV show out there, listen carefully, gentlemen, behind the glass. You ever seen the show called The Drugs Made Me Do It?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's a show, I forget what channel it's on. And Mike Catholic was telling me about this one episode where there was an MMA fighter jacked up on high doses of steroids, doing speed, decided it was a good idea to do some mushrooms. Next thing he knows, he's in jail. He has a complete blackout, doesn't know what's happened. Well, the cops have been called. When the cops get there, he's standing there covered head to toe in blood with his friend's heart in his mouth.
Oh, my gosh.
He's torn the guy's heart out with his bare hand. Biography Channel is where it's on. And that
less
is what...
comforting.
Yeah, but that's what's... I don't mean to tell you that your sister's in that kind of danger, but that's the sort of... That's the spectrum of where steroids can take you.
Well, and our concern is, you know, my sister's showing the classic signs of an abused woman. She blames herself for his behavior.
Well, first order of business is to get off the steroids. I mean, this is not going to change that. But anyway, let's talk about her background a little bit. Has she been in abusive relationships before?
No, not that I'm aware of.
And
in fact, they got married very young. They didn't know each other very long. They were teenagers when they got married. This was about 4 years ago.
Okay. And your parents, did they fight a lot? Was there aggression in the home?
No, not at all. We had a very good childhood.
Okay, so this is should be a very manageable situation. Getting him off steroids is going to be harder than you think because he's obviously very invested in all that stuff. But so as long as he's on steroids, this is a risky thing. She's not sort of set up to seek or defend or somehow be predisposed to this. She just got sucked into it.
Right.
It might work to treat her separate from him. Can you get her to get involved in it?
And that's the issue is she's, in order to pacify him, she's going along with him. So she's starting to cut off her relationships with us too, and she's almost to the point where she's completely isolated.
Yeah, you can't let that happen. So here's the two sorts of basic categories of domestic violence. One is something called common couple violence, which is actually kind of what you're describing here. The other is called interpersonal terrorism, where somebody is systematically broken down and abused. Now, this is moving that direction, but my suspicion is it's moving that direction because of the steroids. It's just this way this guy is so paranoid and so manic and so hyped, and she's just trying to manage that by minimizing the aggression that's evoked from him,
right?
By trying not to, you know, in any way poke at him. So this is definitely an abusive situation. It's definitely a dangerous situation because of the steroids. It's not an untreatable situation. Interpersonal terrorism, the only goal is getting the people apart. That's okay. It. They separate them, and you don't really try to get them back together again. This is a situation where you could treat it. You could kind of hope for something working out. But I think if you don't get her to kind of step outside of it and look at it, it's going to keep getting worse, and then it could turn into interpersonal terrorism and become dangerous.
Sure.
So even if it's just you getting her outside of it and going, hey, I talked to a doctor, and he said, here's what's going on. You're getting sucked into this thing. It's probably the steroids. Can we get you some support so at least you can not necessarily even stand up to him, because she won't want to do that. She'll know what that implies, but just manage him. Would she do that?
Well, that's pretty much the advice we've been giving her, we've sought the advice of I guess professionals, and kind of relayed what they're telling us, and they're telling us the same thing. You need to get out now, because you're not going to fix the situation while you're basically under his control, and he's not going to, hit rock bottom enough to want to seek help until you're gone.
But I'm taking a little bit softer approach. I don't disagree with that. I think that absolutely is true. I just don't expect her to do that.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is it's possible. That's sort of a standard approach. But this situation is a little more nuanced, and it is possible to treat her, I think, while she's in there. I think that would be possible. And so someone's just got to, you know, tell her that, and maybe then she'll be motivated to do it, you know?
Sure.
All right?
Sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Give me feedback. You know, call us a couple weeks, let us know how she's doing, okay?
I will do that. Thank you.
All right.
You.
Good luck.
Bye.
Let's go on to Jake. What's up, Jake? Whoops. Sorry.
How's it going?
There you are. What's up, Jake?
How's it going, Drew?
Good.
I just wanted to call and thank you. I was hoping to catch you and Adam, but I've called a couple times. I haven't gotten through. I just want to call and thank you for doing Loveline and basically getting me clean almost 3 years ago.
Good job. What happened?
Well, I was drinking a lot, doing a lot of cocaine, and then buddy turned me on to OxyContin.
Uh-oh.
And that swiftly turned into black tar heroin. And the whole time I was listening to old episodes of Loveline, and like, you guys kept repeating, go to NA, get a sponsor, start doing steps. So there was just one day when I came out and told all my friends, told my family and everything, and went to NA, got a sponsor, started doing steps, and I've been clean for 3 years almost.
Oh, that is incredible. I mean, you did it with pure 12-step outside, no treatment, no nothing?
Yeah, yeah.
That is remarkable. Jake, well done, my friend. That's I've never seen that. Can I tell you that honestly? I'd always tell people, I say, look, you got to go somewhere for 6 months. I just never see it work otherwise. But I can now say I've seen it. I've seen it work just by putting your ass in a chair. How'd you get through the withdrawal?
I don't know. There was somebody at a meeting that told me to take baths, like just go and like sit in a bathtub for hours. And that's what I did. And it was like, you know, you're hot and you're cold and you're sweating and you're freezing all at the same time.
Yeah.
And for some reason, it just got me through it.
Oh, my God, Jake. That's inspiring. And are you helping other people now?
I'm not ready to be a sponsor yet.
Okay. Fair enough.
But hopefully soon, I think, with working with my sponsor, I'll be able to get there.
Don't do it before you're ready. That's a very enlightened statement to say, I'm not ready and I'm following direction 3 years out. That my partner, a recovering physician that I worked with for over a decade, I knew he was a good resource. I was trying to get him to come work with me, and he kept saying, no, they're telling me I'm not ready. They're telling me I'm not ready. And he was like 3 years sober too at that point. And about 2 years later, he came up to me and goes, you know, they said I could start doing this now. And now in retrospect, he was not ready. And helping other addicts will evoke you. It's like carrying an anvil around. And if you step in a puddle that's deep, you'll go down. So that's really important that you're following those kinds of directions. But it's also important to be of service in the meantime. Are you being of service somewhere?
Yeah, I'm a CSR representative for my NA meeting to go to the area and represent them.
Do you understand that you're an inspiration? You sound kind of tentative when I say that.
Yeah, I kind of share the same thing that you and Adam do as far as, like, low self-esteem and inability to take compliments and all that stuff. So,
well, I was listening to a lecture from a UCLA social psychologist last couple of days, and he was talking about how people with low self-esteem, people with high self-esteem won't take negative feedback because they don't believe it. It doesn't fit their self-concept. While people with low self-esteem, it confirms their self-concept, and then they go, okay, well, I got to work on this. So it will work for you. Even though it's hard to accept good things, it will help you keep improving. So it's a mixed blessing. Mixed blessing, my friend.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right, Jake. You are an inspiration, and God bless you. Keep going. Just doing what you're doing. It's very simple when you do it, but it's not easy.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. This is Hope. What's up, Hope?
Hello.
What's going on?
Oh, there's a lot of things going on right now.
Why are you whispering?
Because I don't want anybody to hear me right now.
But, I mean, who could hear you?
My kids and stuff.
Okay. Okay.
But I really need help because I had some cosmetic things done, and they didn't turn out right.
What happened? What was the procedure?
Yeah, they're fillers.
So facial fillers by a plastic surgeon?
Yeah.
And what happened?
Well, I was at a med spa, and they didn't turn out right.
What happened?
It doesn't even look like me now, and I don't have the money to get it fixed. I'm going through a bad marriage right now where I'm trapped with my husband right now where I can't even go anywhere without my glasses on and be in public, you know, around people. And I just want to be able to get this fixed where I feel, you know, I look okay and not like this hideous monster, and be able to move on forward with my kids and get separated from my husband. He's always putting me down. I mean, I got this done because I lost a lot of weight, and he was telling me he's going to cheat on me, that I looked horrible. I mean, I had a doctor recommend this, but it didn't turn out right, and I have no money to get it fixed right now.
What do you mean get it fixed? What would they do exactly?
They would just even it out.
I see. So there's some irregularity in where the fillers are?
Yeah.
And by evening it out, you'd get more fillers?
Yeah.
Okay. So you just need some symmetry.
Yes.
Where?
In the face.
Where?
In the cheekbones, in the front of the face.
Okay. And in terms of this marriage, how long have you been married?
20 years.
And when did it go bad?
It's been for a couple of years, but last year it just got worse.
Is something wrong with him? Has he been doing drugs or anything precipitating trouble?
No, he just wasn't working, and everything would be my fault when things would go wrong.
Okay.
I mean,
how peculiar after 19 years, he suddenly gets abusive. That's kind of funny.
Well, there's no physical abuse, but I mean mentally, I mean everything is my fault. He would tell me he would cheat on me, that he's going to cheat on me. It's just horrible telling me that I'm ugly.
I'm not excusing it. It is horrible, and emotional abuse can be as devastating as physical abuse. Make no mistake about it.
Yeah.
But it's just peculiar that after 18 years, suddenly he sinks into something overtly abusive. That's kind of weird. But okay. I don't quite get the connection between the surgery, the facial features, and dealing with the marriage. They are completely separate things, truth be known. Why are you hooking these things together?
Because they are.
No, they're not. I understand that you feel like you can't stand on your own 2 feet if your face is funny, but it still doesn't make the getting out any different.
No, I can't even. I wear my glasses all the time. I can't even take them off because I don't feel comfortable going in the store.
I understand.
Or anywhere.
I understand, but if you need to get out of this marriage, you need to begin working on that. Separate from working on these facial things.
But I feel like I can't even get out and get a job and move forward.
Okay, what would you like to do?
Hope,
how can I help? Given that you're saying it's an impossible situation that can't be helped, how can I help?
I am just wanting to find a way. I wish I can get this fixed where I can feel like I don't look like a hideous beast. Then I can get out and get a job and move forward with my kids and support
my kids. So in your mind, the only... Underlined only option is correct the surgery, get a job, get on your feet that way. Is that correct?
Yes, and I don't have to sit there and be dependent on him.
So why don't you go back to the surgeon, go back to the organization that screwed this up, tell them they have to fix it.
You will happily
pay them back when you have a job, but you can't get a job until it's fixed.
They won't do that. They don't do that. They charge you.
Well, then you go to another organization because I guarantee you'll find some place that will put it on some sort of layaway. And you just correct this and let's get the job.
I've tried, and there's nowhere.
Okay, so there's absolutely nothing that can be done. There's absolutely nothing can be done for you. Is that right? You're a hopeless situation. There's zero hope.
I feel like that.
Okay.
That is my situation, and I just want to move forward where I can get a job, get ahead with my kids.
You don't have to repeat that. I've heard that now three times.
Okay. And I don't have to be dependent on him anymore and put up with the mental abuse, him putting me down, and things like that.
I understand.
Hello?
Yeah, I don't know. You've said you can't be helped. I'm trying to understand what I can possibly do to help you.
No, I want to know what you can do to help me. What can I do?
You can go find an organization that will correct this, put it on a layaway until after you've gotten a job and you promise you'll pay them back. You put it on some sort of IOU. That's not true. You'll find a place. I know I would have done that, so therefore here's one practitioner that would have done it. Therefore, there are others. And then you go get a job, and then you carry out your plan. I mean, it's pretty simple. You're right. That's a reasonable plan. However, you are throwing roadblocks in front of it every way you possibly can. And if you continue to say it's not possible and don't find a way to make it work. And by the way, you could get a job with the way your face is now. People will not care. It's in your head. But I understand. That's okay. But you have to find a way to make this work. I guarantee you, Dr. Bruce would do it for God's sake. Where is she? Yeah, call Dr. Bruce. We'd get Bruce to do it. Give her Bruce's number, and I'm sure he would correct this. But you have to get a job. You have to pay him back. You have to carry through on your plan, which I think is what you're actually avoiding. Rhonda, what do you got?
Hi. I'm a grandmother, 55 years old.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter's 28
mm-hmm.
and hooked on methamphetamine.
Mm-hmm.
Oxycontin, anything she can get her hands on.
Okay, what's the question?
I got her two ambulances to come get her last week. She was suicidal and hallucinating.
Okay, how can we help? I'm up against the clock.
I just want to know, is there any way to get somebody to force a person in? She wants help, but she won't stay in a rehab.
Yeah, unfortunately, in this country, you are entitled to use drugs until you die. You can't say, I'm going to kill myself with drugs, but you can't say, I'm God, after I've gotten psychotic from using drugs, but you can keep using drugs. That's how crazy our laws are. And there's nothing we can do about it. Now, what you can do is use every inch of leverage you have and get her into a sober living. That's where she needs to go next, immediately. Either a residential treatment program or a sober living. Just look it up online.
Right.
And don't let her go anywhere from the hospital other than to the sober living. That's the key thing. Once they land somewhere, it's impossible to get them back, into the program.
And they're telling they won't let even talk to me because she's 28 and she's mad at me and she has the
right to do whatever she wants. That's right. It's the craziness in our laws. But we're not allowed to. We are not allowed to help people that really need help. If you could just hold her somewhere for a month, she'd be in her right mind after that.
Exactly.
At least she'd be better.
Exactly.
But you can't. And it's so devastating to see that. So any leverage you have, use it. Keep applying it. Go to Al-Anon, Rhonda. Go to Al-Anon.
I do. Good. I'm a recovering alcoholic myself with 15 years sobriety.
Fantastic.
So you
get
used to this, but
you get it, my dear. You get it.
I'm just giving it to God. Then that's all.
Well,
I can
don't
push it.
Yeah, push. Give it to God for sure. But also do what you can. All right.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Rhonda.
Bye bye.
All right, that about does it for today. Interesting calls. Thank you again, Arthur Kaplan, the head and founding director of Divisions of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center. Check him out online. Check his publications out. He's always doing something interesting in the press and thinking about things that are maybe you don't want to think about all the time. Most recently, he was interested in that lung transplant with the young girl who got the transplant eventually. And by the time, we'll see how that plays out. Again, don't forget to support those that support us here and check out The Boy with the Gun by Brandon Stogsdale at doctor.com and The Swing and Sounds you're listening to right now at doctor.com and click through at Amazon, and we'll keep this pirate ship going. See you next time.
This is Corolla Digital.